on behalf of the staff and management of The Talking Place, WWGH 107.1 FM and WWGH1071.com. We'd like to wish you a very happy, healthy, and prosperous 2018. This is Adam Lepp with a special tribute to the many fine celebrities and interesting guests who have graced our microphones throughout 2017. Our very own Scott Spears. I call him the interviewer to the stars. Throughout his long radio career, has had the pleasure of speaking with some of the most interesting people from the world of politics, sports, and show business, as well as interesting people from right here in Marion. 2017 was no exception. For example, one of the highlights of 2017 was Scott's interview with former Massachusetts governor and Democratic presidential candidate Michael Dukakis.
When you ran then, because your personal life does become involved and your time becomes involved, what did it take to run for political office then, and what do you tell your students it takes to run today?
Strangely, despite the fact that obviously communications are different, we're in a kind of electronic age and we've got emails and social media and all that kind of stuff, it hasn't changed very much. I mean, first you've got to be strongly committed to changing things, to making things better. I mean, I don't know of anyone who goes into politics to show up and put in the day. I mean, all of us who run for office, no matter where we're coming from philosophically, are doing so because we have very strong feelings about the world we live in. So that's kind of number one. Secondly, you better like people and enjoy working with them. And there's nothing better than working with people and trying to make your life and the lives of your fellow citizens better. I mean, that's one of the things we do. And there's enormous personal fulfillment and satisfaction, Scott, in being in a position where you can make a difference in the lives of people. And after many, many years at this, Kitty and I are still at it, and we still are able to help folks in many, many ways, and it's there's no better feeling, frankly. So, you know, for all of those reasons, one gets involved. And you start slow, and you start at a pretty basic level. I started in local government at a very basic level, and then managed to do fairly well at that level and started moving up, get into the state legislature, and then subsequently was elected governor.
You know, Governor Dukakis, it's kind of interesting, and I think of it this week with President Trump and the whole wiretap story. There is this thing now when it comes to politics that because the president has said things that are untrue, nobody wants to use the term lied, but all politicians lie. That's kind of the backup from the press, or the Trump supporters. He lied, but all politicians do it. You were a pretty heavy-duty politician. Did Michael Dukakis lie? Is that with the territory?
Let me tell you, anybody who tells you that is either a knave or a fool. I can't imagine deliberately lying and being in public life. For two reasons. First, it's a dumb thing to do. And secondly, given the press corps we have, the media we have, and so on, you'll never get away with it. Now, frankly, I don't understand at this point what makes Trump tick. I don't know whether he deliberately lies or he says things that are untrue and he thinks they're true. Either way, it's kind of pathological. But you never know with this guy. And then when he says, well, the previous president wiretapped him, then he says, well, I meant wiretapping in a broad sense, whatever that means. Well, you know, you can't be a governor or a president and be free and easy with language. I mean, people are paying close attention to it. If you're president of the United States, you're probably the most important political figure in the world. And as I say, I don't know whether it's deliberate with him or whether it's just carelessness. Maybe it's a combination of both. But it isn't making his life any better. It's not making our lives any better. And frankly, I think I wish he'd just, you know, get off this Twitter stuff and start governing. I mean, we're right now in the middle of a major debate over health care and whether or not working Americans and their families are going to have decent, affordable health care in this country. I mean, that's the fundamental issue here. So this guy during the campaign said, hey, elect me and you'll all have health insurance. And it will be less expensive. And now he's working overtime to try to get a bill through the House, which has to be one of the worst pieces of legislative nonsense I've ever seen. I mean, it's a terrible bill. Millions of Americans will lose their health insurance as a result of it. It's very unfair. It gives the wealthy another tax cut. And this is not what Donald Trump, candidate for the presidency of the United States, said at the time, or said, by the way, during the transition. Now, does he understand that he's telling us he's doing now something that is totally contrary to what he told us he was going to do when he was a candidate? I don't know, but I will say this to you. Anybody in public life who deliberately either misstates the truth or knowingly lies about something, first, doesn't belong in public life, and secondly, he's going to be doing a terrible job in himself and the administration he's working for, because nobody's going to put up with this stuff.
When Scott asked legendary game show host Bob Barker to come on down and talk to him on the air, well, Bob Barker said yes. Another great interview from 2017. Bob Barker, host of Truth or Consequences, and of course, The Price is Right.
Do you ever, you're a complete success at retirement, but
that's
do you ever get the urge to go back and do something?
No, I don't really. I was back on the show as a guest. Actually, it was April Fool's Day. I was the I was the Price is Right April Fool. And I was behind the doors where Drew Carey makes his and they said, now here's the star of our show, and they opened the doors, and there I was, not Drew, and they just applauded wildly, and I came out and talked about being selected, very carefully selected as a fool, and actually started the show, got the contestants down, contestants rolled, did the bidding, got one of them up on stage and played a pricing game, and it just all went very well, and it was fun. And I then I said goodbye, and Drew came on and did the show. And backstage, several people said, "Barker, you could do the show right now. You did that just fine. You could do the show." And I told them, I said, I did one game. That's not an hour. And I'm just too old to face that.
So at this point, you think to go back and do something like that may not be the best idea?
To go back and try to do the show again?
Just maybe do a special hour. Do the whole hour.
Or I that's tough. That Price is Right. Unlike so many shows, the host is not just sitting there and talking with people, or he's moving around. He's all over the stage, and you have to keep the audience up. At least I did during commercials. I never left the stage. Now some of the hosts do leave the stage, and the announcer takes over during commercials. I didn't do that. I stayed out there, and it was a show for the whole hour, because I tried to keep the audience up. You get them up, and you don't want to try to start them over every time after every commercial, and at least I didn't. And it is physically, as well as mentally, a pretty long hour.
Do you watch The Price is Right?
Did I what?
Do you watch The Price is Right?
No, I don't watch it. I check it occasionally, but I don't watch it daily, no.
Were you happy with Drew Carey?
Yes. Drew is a very nice fellow. And when I was leaving the show, you know, I closed every show with my plug, help control the pet population, have your pet spayed or neutered. And I was hopeful that whoever took over would continue that. And when Drew was chosen, and the first meeting, I was going to suggest to him that he continue my plug. And before I could say, how do you do, he said, Bob, I want you to know that every day, as long as I do the show, I'll do your spay-neuter plug. And I kissed him on the lips.
You know, Bob, I was thinking, when you left that show in 2007, 35 years, you were so synonymous with that show. Did you have any fear that it might have gone away? Sometimes when there's a host change, it doesn't go over well.
Well, I certainly hoped that it wouldn't go away, because I was going to get well paid, not as well as if I had done the show, but I had a deal where I had a royalty for a certain amount of time, and it's just about to play out now, so I may have to look for a job. But I hoped it would go on, and it has, and it's going along strongly.
Did you ever consider, when The Price is Right was over, doing something else?
No. If I had any interest in doing something else, I would have never left The Price is Right, because I was doing the show as well as I'd ever done it, and I didn't want to, but it was becoming more and more tiring to do the show. And I didn't want to stay on and have it start going downhill and having people saying, Barker's just too old, he ought to get off there, and that sort of thing. I wanted to stop while I was at the top of my game, and that's just what I did.
Here at WWGH, we don't shy away from controversial guests, folks whose opinions may not be the same as most of our listeners. One guest from 2017 who definitely fits that description was white nationalist Jason Kessler.
What is Unite the Right?
Well, the original idea of Unite the Right was to stand up for the monuments, not just Confederate monuments, but all the monuments to Europeans or European Americans, which have come under attack by police anti-white attitudes. We wanted to make it so that white people could be able to do marches and so forth without being stigmatized. Obviously, the opposite of that has happened. And then finally, we wanted to stand up for free speech, and that has been curtailed as well. The idea of Unite the Right was we were going to bring together some of the more controversial elements of the right wing, such as white nationalists, along with people who are just run-of-the-mill folks, normal Trump supporters, Confederate heritage people, white advocates, whoever, so that they could stand up against what we viewed as a totalitarian communist crackdown of our civil liberties. And to be honest with you, that's exactly what happened, is a communist totalitarian crackdown of our civil liberties occurred on Saturday.
How do you believe that happened?
Well, basically, the mayor of Charlottesville, Mike Signer, declared Charlottesville the capital of the resistance against Trump. The vice mayor of Charlottesville, Wes Bellamy, had a lot of anti-white views, which played into him spearheading the effort to take down the statue. For instance, he said, white women are the devil. He said, my favorite thing about being down south is seeing the look on the faces of little white men when they have to look up to a black man. He went on and on and on. I don't listen to white people. I hate seeing them around town. So these people were working with Governor Terry McAuliffe, who is a Clintonite. He's part of the Clinton machine. And they rescinded the permit for our rally. All right. So the significance of that was that we had been working for 2 months with police department officials who had a security plan in place to bring our speakers into the event, to keep counter demonstrators and demonstrators separate so that we would both be able to exercise our First Amendment rights. We asked them all kinds of legal questions like, is this okay? Is that okay? We had it all figured out. Then the city rescinded the permit based on First Amendment violations. And that's not just my opinion. We sued them in federal court. A federal court judge found that they had tried to cancel our permit based on the content of our speech rather than any kind of other concerns about, like, crowd sizes, for instance, because the city had granted 2 permits for counter demonstrators within each within 1 block of our event. So the city put a ticking time bomb down in front of our demonstration where we had applied 2 months in advance for the permit. Then they put these violent Antifa and Black Lives Matter on either side of us. Then the federal court judge rules the night before the rally that the permit is back in place. So police had assured us that we would go back to our original security plan with cops stationed outside the event, 180 cops stationed in the back to help people exit in an orderly fashion, in a safe fashion, and none of those things happened. The morning of the rally, it was just we got ambushed. We were trying to we had shuttles of people going in along with our speakers. They were supposed to have police escorts. Charlottesville Police Department did not show up. So when we came to the entrances, we were greeted by people throwing hydrochloric acid in our eyes, macing us. Some people have seen pictures of these masked Black Lives Matter guys carrying improvised flamethrowers. That's the kind of stuff that we were greeted with.
A funny and talented gentleman whom Scott has interviewed many times also visited our airwaves in 2017. Legendary actor Charles Grodin.
In your experience, is the world of show business filled with different type of characters?
Yeah, there's a lot of unusual people, let's put it like that.
Is that why you decided to join that profession?
I had no idea.
You really? No idea going in, but you stayed.
I had no idea. I just decided to do it. I don't know. I thought I could do it. Actually, the reason I became an actor, I had already enrolled at the University of Pittsburgh to be a journalism major, and I saw a movie starred Elizabeth Taylor. And I had the kind of ego that I thought, well, I think I'll become a movie. I'll go to Hollywood and meet Elizabeth Taylor. I mean, that's the kind of confidence I had. And many years later, I never met Elizabeth Taylor, but many years later I was at some event and I was telling the story and the people in front of me were listening and chuckling. But behind me, there was the loudest laugh I ever heard. That was Elizabeth Taylor.
Well, she had a big laugh.
Yeah, big laugh.
She had like a Phyllis Diller laugh.
Yeah, and so she was... Yeah, she was quite a beauty.
Beautiful. Now, do you have the commentaries written out that you do for CBS?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Hey, give me one.
Oh, boy. I don't know. Let me see. Let me just look here a minute and see if I have something written on a pad nearby.
Oh, you just write them on legal pads?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Where do you tape them?
Say it again?
How do you tape them?
I do them at home.
Oh, you have a little studio.
Well, no, but I could do it. My son helps me with it.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Is it all done on the computer?
As far as I know.
Is a computer in front of you when you record them?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Or some kind of, something's in front of me.
Some device.
Here's one. I just read this. I think this went into the Times, because I sent stuff and published in papers sometime. Sometimes they say you just have to suck it up and do what has to be done. It was the birthday recently of a close family member who has dementia. Sometimes I'll call and he'll curse me out for reasons unknown. I called and happily went well. Later that day I saw in the news that Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor, Nobel Prize winner, had died. He was the same age as my family member. I don't remember how. Years ago, I had lunch with Elie Wiesel, survivor of the Holocaust and Nobel Prize winner. Some things you never forget.
There's a great irony there.
Yeah.
Wow. Did you think about that?
Yeah, I'm just curious. When I was 15, I ran and won the presidency of my homeroom in high school. At 18, Elie Wiesel, and once wrote a book, a bestseller, but Nobel Prize authors don't look at me.
Did that make air? What was that, Charles?
I don't know what that was, but I I really was able to spend some time with people. It's like a dream.
Mm-hmm.
It's so special.
Yeah, I can. Is your mouth actually on the receiver of the phone?
Right. Is this better?
Oh, that's better.
Yeah, it's better. No,
yeah,
what
were you talking into?
No, it just was. It didn't have it close enough.
Oh, that's much better, Charles.
Okay.
I don't want to lose a minute of this because it's going to go into the time capsule. I don't want them to have to strain their ears.
As a talk show host, Scott has the pleasure of speaking with other talk show hosts. One of the hosts whom I believe has had a large influence on Scott's career due to his cerebral and in-depth interviewing approach is Dick Cavett.
I feel that Cavett is the most like me because he's more interested in conversation than asking questions.
That's a great point.
It's a great quote. I think,
as you know.
Yes, absolutely. I prove it every day. And but then he ends with a zinger on you. He says, I was later surprised to hear Dick Cavett one night use a French term déjà vu and pronounce it déjà vu when it is déjà vu. My goodness. What are they teaching at Yale? Too much bula bula and not enough skula skula. Check bar.
That's
1983.
Interesting. By the way, he's dead wrong on that, of course. Déjà vu would mean already you. Déjà vu, not the vu, which your teacher would say to you, round your lips for O, but pronounce E, and you will get E, the French U. So déjà vu is as wrong as honing in, when they mean homing in. But anyway, Jack is just priceless, and he told me once the most astounding fact of my life, practically. He said I made a terrible mistake leaving The Tonight Show, that he was in a bad season, bad mood, possibly depression, and he just missed it like hell. Now, if you ask the average person who loved the Parier, how long was Jack on The Tonight Show? People will say anything from 6 years to 12 years. And it was, in fact, sadly, 5. Johnny for 31 or whatever. What a difference.
Do you remember him having this fascination with your height?
No, but actually a couple of my writers needed something about me physically. And I was taller than Woody, and I was wasn't fat enough to do fat jokes about, or Jewish enough, or Italian enough to be or hard of hearing or seeing or whatever. So they picked on size. Actually, size, and I've never revealed this, was at its peak, so to speak, 5'6 3/4".
Oh, it's official.
So that's not really, Billy Barty the midget, you would have thought so. But that line about holding me up to watch a parade is genius.
And he bought you a balloon.
Yeah.
Even a balloon.
Bought me a balloon. Yeah, that's really wonderful.
Yeah, that's...
Jack was one of the greatest ad-libbers there's ever been. One night... He just sat there while... Remember Fat Jack Leonard, the wonderful comedian Jackie Leonard?
Yeah.
Jack decided that he was going to let the other Jack just run out and not come back at him. Because Jack Parr said to me backstage, you know, if you don't come back at him, pal, he doesn't know, he doesn't know where to go. So Jack did that to Fat Jack. And he was sort of sputtering finally, the poor guy. And Jackie Leonard... in a mental panic, just reached for the first fact, I guess, that he could think of. It wasn't the population of Nicaragua, but it might as well have been. Instead of, you know, my wife is a bat, and Jack said she'd have to be.
a frequent guest of Scott's, celebrated her 90th birthday earlier this year. Scott went to visit her at her home on beautiful Cape Cod in Massachusetts. Longtime actress, voice of Ursula from The Little Mermaid, Pat Carroll.
The Macy's Parade started in the 20s. The Miracle on 34th Street started or came out in the 40s. It's a Wonderful
right.
Life was about that time as well. But
right.
These are the things that here, 70, 90 years later, we still do these traditions every year.
That's right.
I wonder what we did.
You know
before.
Why? Those films that they made at that time were almost prophetic. And they were also rather brilliantly of their time. And that time had a great deal to do with importance about family and celebration and tradition. And we can never lose tradition in this country.
And you know what, Pat?
If we do, we're in big trouble.
With something interesting, they all have a happy ending.
Yep. And what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
Where can you go for a happy ending except in books or movies? And now maybe television occasionally. But what's wrong with a happy ending? Do people want people to be pickle pusses and go around with negative, negative, negative all the time? No! Let's be kids with a happy ending. Do you ever see children going to get books that don't have a happy ending? No, they're smart. We aren't.
You know, Pat, it's interesting. I never thought about this, but I got a question today when I announced you were going to be on the program. And, of course, one of your signature characters that you played was a villain, Ursula, in The Little Mermaid.
Absolutely.
The question is, and this is interesting, what would Ursula think of Thanksgiving?
Oh, she'd hate it. She would absolutely hate it. Are you kidding? All those people being happy and eating and enjoying themselves, how dare they?
How?
With all the problems in the world, look at them trying to be happy. That's Ursula.
How do you explain her to people?
I don't even try to explain her. Ursula is just Ursula. And there are some people in our world who are Ursulas. And so that's fine. That's what diversity makes our world fascinating. And Ursula, to me, is a fascinating character.
What would the world be without villains? How would you know who the good people were?
That's right. In comparison is what gives you the answer. And you know what? For the most part, and I've been like this since I was a kid, I've always liked the villains better than the heroes.
Mm.
They're more interesting.
They
because we find ourselves in them more than we do in the itsy-poo, adorable, angelic leading people.
Now, Pat, I just learned this statistic today that over 50% of people will put up the Christmas tree Thanksgiving night. Now, do you put your decorations up?
No.
No.
No. The week before Christmas.
Oh, the week before Christmas.
Yeah, because Thanksgiving is its own holiday. It isn't Christmas. It's Thanksgiving. You know, so decorate your table gorgeously and let food reign as king. But no, the Christmas tree does not go up in my house until a week before Christmas, sometimes just 4 days.
Speaking of legendary talk show hosts, Scott traveled to New York City to speak with Dayton, Ohio native Phil Donahue.
If there's one thing I'm proud of, as a result of the history, and I get a lot of attention now. No sad songs for me. I mean, people come up to me in airports all the time, you know. Mr. Donahue, I'm Mr. Donahue now, so you want to keep that in mind, Scott. Mr. Donahue, thank you for your show. Because of your show, I got out of an abusive marriage. Thank you for your show, Mr. Donahue. Because of your show, I came out to my parents. And one of the comments I'm getting more and more often lately is, thank you, Mr. Donahue, because of your show, I learned to speak English. Mm. Now, that's as, you know, I would wish this on anybody I love. it's just a wonderful feeling to realize that you've reached that many people and in many ways changed their lives. And I don't think that's an overstatement. It'd be better if somebody else told you this, but I am a lucky duck. I just feel very grateful.
Your show did do that, Mr. Donahue. I have no problem calling you Mr. Donahue at all.
Well, I am older now, you know.
When you were on the air, nobody did what you did. I'm not sure if they've done it since. I know the idea is that Oprah and Sally, and they all evolved from you. To a degree, going out in the audience, they did that. But nobody did exactly what you did, because you also had, I think about it today with Trump, you had the people involved in Watergate on, but then the next day you might have male strippers on. Do you call that variety? How do you define your show?
Well, first thing to know is that there were approximately 9 or 11 the people outside my office door. Actually, there were like 30 when we got complicated and bureaucratic and had to deal with stations and sponsors and so on. But the 9 producers of the show were mostly female. The show began with a woman as a producer. Of course, the director was a man. And we also, you know, I also felt that I couldn't be a hypocrite. We hired our first black female very early on when the show started to make a little noise. And I hired her, this would be late 60s. I hired her because she had the largest afro. I mean, this is how superficial the liberals can be. I guess a lot of luck. First of all, we had a general manager who didn't drop his tools and run. We had a guest who said, "All automobile dealers are crooks." That was the name of his book, I think. His name was Tony Till. I'll never forget this. Well, the entire Automobile Dealers Association of the Miami Valley, Southwest Ohio, canceled not only the Donahue show, but all their advertising on the entire station.
Mm.
So I had salesmen outside my office door, you know, who just lost their local car dealership. And it's hard to give a free speech lesson to a guy who's got 2.5 kids and, you know, his income is now diminished because this guy Donahue. Well, we took the Automobile Dealers Association to lunch. We stroked them. We did everything we could, and we did finally get him back.
Cookie creator Wally Famous Amos also graced our airwaves in 2017.
When Andy Kaufman was getting ill at the end, he played Carnegie Hall. Were you a part of that in some way at the end?
I was not a part of his live performance, though. I never was. But in Taxi, you know, he started making cookies, and he was using his grandmother's recipe and the cocoa beans, you know. And there's some effect that chocolate has a certain hypnotizing effect on you, and that Andy was putting cocoa in his cookies, and he doesn't care too. I don't know whether this is true or not, but the cocoa powder and stuff, it has kind of an additional effect, kind of has a dizzying effect, and that there might be little shades of cocaine connected with that. I've never researched it, and I don't know. But they're still selling cocoa beans and chocolate, so obviously if it was also cocaine in it, then the government would have had something to do with it. To do with taking that off the marketplace, but that was the reasoning on that.
For those who don't know, what did happen that brought an end to your association with Famous Amos?
I just lost the company. I was not a businessman, and I'm still not a businessman. I can't get that together, but I still make some business mistakes, but not as many as before because I have some people that work with me now. And I don't always agree with those people either. That's just the way life is. But I just made mistakes, man. Made mistakes. And because I was famous, I could do whatever I wanted to do. But that doesn't mean that whatever I wanted to do was always right. So I made a lot of mistakes. And when you make mistakes and other people come in and start buying pieces of the company, then every time someone comes in and buys some of the equity, then your portion of that equity or the ownership of the company is reduced. And so I wound up having a minority ownership in the company. And in time, it was no longer Wally's company, although the name is still Wally Amos. That was the brand name. But I was no longer a part of it. And the company that took over, there was a guy that was the president of that company. And I went in to visit him in his office during the very, very early days. And he just kind of said, you know, Wally, I guess the truth of the matter is we don't need you anymore.
Another of Scott's most interesting guests from 2017 was President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his wife Eleanor Roosevelt's granddaughter, Eleanor Roosevelt Seagraves.
Ellie, what was your childhood like?
What were my parents like?
Your childhood.
Oh, my childhood. Well, it was a very interesting one, of course. I was very lucky. My brother and I were together all the time. He was Curtis. He's 3 years younger. And when we were when I was 6 or 7 and he was 3 and 4, my mother was divorced, got a divorce from our father, and Curtis Dell, and we moved with her parents, our grandparents, to the White House, where we lived for about 2 or 3 years till we moved to New York City. So we had those early years at the White House. And, you know, we didn't know the significance of the White House, obviously. At that age, nobody told us about the big house. It was a little larger than the house at Hyde Park, but, you know, we weren't very spoiled. You'd think children brought up in the White House would be very spoiled brats. And I was just active, very full of energy and all that sort of thing, but we were not spoiled. We were not loaded up with toys and fancy clothes and all that sort of thing. And my mother, Anna, who was the only daughter of Franklin and Eleanor, she believed in doing things with a great deal of foresight, so that we were not expecting a lot of things. And for instance, my mother and grandmother would arrange a birthday party now and then for either my brother or me, excuse my old lady voice, at the White House. And we'd have children of her friends or staff friends, and that's plus our some school friends, and we'd watch little movies in the East Room sitting on the floor, you know, where they have the press conferences now. So we were just kids sitting on the floor, watching early movies, the Catch and Jammer Kids, that sort of thing. And afterwards, we would have of course, my grandparents and my grandmother always said, no presents, but of course everybody came with presents. And we were not allowed even to look at them.
We were thanked for them, and, well, we didn't, but the staff person thanked whoever brought this or that, the other thing. But we were not allowed to have all that stuff. Instead, my grandmother and mother had several places around town, orphanages or hospital, children's hospitals, various homes for where little children would reside, and all of our stuff, we didn't have it. It went there, which was a very good thing to do. If it had a blown fat heads, because, we were just children who happened to live in the White House with a very nice family.
A gentleman who was involved in a very controversial and widespread news story in 2017, former River Valley teacher Mark Bollinger.
Mr. Peterson told me that, you know, the news media and stuff like that would probably be aware of it and things like that, and it would probably be best for my family and myself to just resign and keep it quiet. But I wasn't doing that. I've been brought up and things like that by my parents, and I've been very, very blessed by my parents, my family, my friends, my church family, that, you know, if you make a mistake, admit it. But also, you stand up for what's right, even if you're standing alone. And if I had done that, I would have, you know, taken ownership and said, I made a mistake, I screwed up, and I would have dealt with the consequences. I would have deserved that. But the reality is I never had a relationship or anything that I was accused of by River Valley with a student during that time, and I wasn't going to resign because I didn't do anything wrong.
So at that point, they fired you?
Well, at that point then, what I was told by our union representative is that our Board of Education president was pushing to terminate me at the next board meeting, which would have been at the end of June of 2015. Again, something that, you know, talking about transparency. The other female involved in this, the what they called, quote, best friend of the young lady that, you know, that was involved in this. First of all, there's a lot more in the background of those two young ladies. If you actually want to dig and look at the documents that show what was actually taking place and had taken place. However, talking about transparency, the best friend was the Board of Education president's stepdaughter. He raised her. Okay. What business did he have participating in the discussions, voting, and being involved in the entire process like he was when it was a complete conflict of interest as his stepdaughter was involved, came in and testified or was part of the investigation, yet he never removed himself from it. That's the transparency I'm talking about. We have other board members who, for example, one of our board members, his brother-in-law, used to be the boys basketball coach at River Valley. He would abstain, would refuse to vote or participate in discussion because his brother-in-law was up for a supplemental contract. Something as simple as that. Yet, the River Valley Board president, his stepdaughter was involved, and in this situation where a teacher, where my career and my life and my family's life was completely destroyed and turned upside down, and he didn't abstain from any discussions or conflict or voting, not really transparent. But that hasn't come out. That story hasn't been told.
Without a doubt, one of the funniest people ever to be on our airwaves, legendary comedian Shecky Green.
Well, you know, I've heard from a lot of people that Ed really was just lucky, that he really didn't know exactly what he was doing.
No, now let me explain to you that. So you happen to get to the right guy today, because I've got nothing to do, so I'm going to break the other leg.
Go ahead.
Ed Sullivan, Milton Berle used to host the dance thing in the fall. I forget what they called it, but it was every fall they had this dance, and they would go into theaters. They would go on tour. Harvest Moon Festival, that was called. So they would go into theaters, big theaters all across the country, and Milton Berle would MC the thing. So one time Milton Berle couldn't do it, and he says, get Ed Sullivan, because Ed Sullivan, you know, gets up on things. So they used Ed Sullivan to go on the theaters, and that became a thing for him, to go with these groups, and that's how they got the show, the Ed Sullivan Show.
Well, why was it that Ed Sullivan became a staple in television, and Milton Berle, who was famously talented, really only had the one success?
Oh, no. Scott, no.
No, I'm wrong.
Yes, you're wrong. Berle, I mean, you couldn't be any bigger than Berle.
Well, right, but you know what's fascinating about Berle is he did the Texaco Star Theater. NBC gave him a lifetime contract, but once the Star Theater was over, was there another successful television show?
No, because by that time, things started to bounce and things started to come in, you know, and it was just over. It was time for it to be over. But, I mean, every Sunday, people just were glued to their television, and it was that big. But Berle stayed big, you know.
What was he like? People say he was a perfectionist, difficult.
I loved Berle, and he was. Berle was a little crazy on his side, but I loved Berle. He was what he was. He was a clown, you know. He was a Red Skelton. Red Skelton was nuts, too. I mean, I had things with Red Skelton you wouldn't believe. And Red Skelton was brilliant. Red Skelton was at the Riviera, and I'm at the Riviera. He says, oh, Shaky, God bless. Could you come? I got a brand new car, Rolls Royce. Could you come down? So I came down. We looked at his Rolls Royce, and he starts screaming and yelling and crying and throwing up. And I said, what's the matter? They gave him the wrong color, Rolls Royce. And when he saw the color that, Scott, when he saw the color of that car, he got crazy. Oh, Shaggy, look what they did to me, Shaggy. Oh, God bless. You know? And I said, Red, they'll get you another color. You know, they'll get you a fire wagon if you want.
Certainly one of our favorite grumpy but lovable TV characters was Lou Grant from Mary Tyler Moore and the show Lou Grant. Legendary actor, activist, and author. Ed Asner spoke with Scott in 2017.
People listening see Ed Asner a lot because every 5 minutes they play the movie Elf on television. And Ed Asner is Santa Claus and Elf. Of course, Mary Tyler Moore is still in repeats with a lot of other Roots. We see Roots a lot. When you choose a role, what makes you decide on whether I'm going to do this or I'm not going to do it?
It makes me smile. Smile at its cleverness or its uniqueness. If it's a departure from ordinary crap.
Is there anything you would not play?
Well, there has to be some individual trait that stands out with the character. A believability and a oneness, a uniqueness.
Acting fascinates me because when you get that role, when you get that script, how much of Ed Asner lives in that character? Because if nothing else, the character does sort of look like you.
Yeah. I think they just cheated it, made it easy on themselves. So they drew me. What was the question?
How do you become that character? Why is Lou Grant different? How much of you is in those characters? Santa Claus, Lou Grant, the man from Roots. How much of Ed Asner lives in all those characters?
Well, I think as I say his words, whoever the character is, if I believe the truth of what I'm saying, then I feel I'm on the right direction. It would be very difficult for me to say on this phone call that I love you. You. I mean you. You are so important to me. You're the only reason I'm alive. You. You above all. I need you. I want you. I've got to be with you. Now, I am envisioning someone utterly different than who you are, but I hope I convinced you that you're the one.
We sincerely hope you've enjoyed listening to this 2017 tribute to our most interesting guests on the Scott Spears Now Show. Thank you, as always, for listening to The Talking Place, WWGH. And stay tuned for more great interviews from Scott Spears in 2018. This is Adam Lipp. Happy New Year.